Greetings, I'm your host Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you are a returning listener or subscriber, and you heard that intro music and knew it was time to get down, welcome back! And we're talking about something that I got to do for several years, all over various parts of this beautiful emerald sphere we call Earth. Punk music. If you like that intro, and if you don't like the intro, I don't care. But if you like that intro, it's my band Bitter Lake, and one of the playlists that's up with all these playlists from our music series is actually the live set playlist to our live set. Most of those songs are songs that we play live, and I've been ordered by one of the members to do at least one more show, so we're trying to do one more show. Speaking of live shows, June 8th at Bus Boys and Poets in Washington, D.C., we will be live!
You have been an unnatural elite.
Oops. Beyond the Black Jacobin, C.L.R. James and the Struggle for Socialism in America, Adolf Reed, my co-host, my homie, my dog, Pascal Robert, Daniel Tutt, Derek Varn, me, as MC calls him, my stunt double Billy Bunton. Apparently, there's going to be an after party. We're still planning that out. Well, that's going to be even more speakers that couldn't fit on the main show. So get your tickets now, wherever you are watching or listening to the show. There should be links in the description to get tickets to that. Also, unlike when Ben and I do a live thing, this is actually going to be streamed. So if you can't make it out to DC, you can still see the shindig. That being said, it is just me tonight. Pascal and MT have the night off as they'll be filling in for me tomorrow, Saturday. The history of punk music in the Soviet Union. How many of you know anything about punk music in the Soviet Union? I know the online Stalinists won't dig this episode, but one thing I love is punk and metal music. I've had the opportunity to play and record it all over the place. And if you've read the best-selling pamphlet on Everyday Analysis, I Was a Teenage Anarchist, then you also know I'm intrigued about the history of punk. And punk's history in the USSR is a complex story of a true underground movement at odds with state repression. Unlike its American counterpart, Soviet punk didn't have a definitive sound. There wasn't a music industry or a media apparatus to tell young aspiring counterculturists what was good and what punk is supposed to look like. There was no tape trading scene helped by physical media magazines like you had in the West. In the Soviet scene, people learned how to press vinyl on X-rays. We'll talk about that in the show as well. That's really interesting. We're also going to talk about the documentary film that my good friend and TIR cousin, if you will. Alexander's like a TIR cousin. Has completed discussing what happened to the punk scene with the Russians that have fled since the Ukraine war. So please welcome TIR cousin, Alexander Herbert.
You call me Unk. You call me T.I.R. Unk.
Unk? You're Unk?
I was watching a video last night. It was like a comedy one where someone called like a dude Unk, and he was like, wait a minute, how old do you think I am? And the kid was like 35. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, that means you Unk. You
damn.
Unk. I was like, damn, all right. All right.
Yeah, you know, yeah, my daughter's boyfriend, they've been together, Jesus, 6-7 years, and ever since they met, he's been calling me pops. So I'm starting to get okay.
Hey man, you do you.
My elder statesman role. Oh no, spring allergies.
Yeah, the northeast is, it was actually really warm the other day for the northeast, but it's good. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Sorry to divert here.
No. This is actually a really interesting topic. I don't think people know too much about this scene, because I think when we think about music, we think that it's just everywhere. And, you know, we forget that there is this thing called the Iron Curtain. And how did punk even infiltrate this Iron Curtain? And what did the Soviet Cultural Commission have against it?
Yeah, I think this is a cool opportunity to talk kind of informally about this. So because I wrote this book, we can argue about the cover photo some other day, but I wrote this book. It's published by Microcosm. It came out in 2019. And when it came out, I did a book talk tour in Canada, Eastern Canada, and the Eastern United States. And I had the West Coast tour planned. I was going flying to Seattle, renting a car, driving all the way down to Las Vegas to talk about it. I had all the venues booked, and then COVID happened and I had to cancel everything. So it didn't end up happening. I never had the opportunity to talk about the book on the West Coast. So, I mean, this kind of fills in for it. But this is a cool opportunity. I haven't talked about this topic or the book in a while, but you know, I talked about it so much and so frequently that it's fresh in my mind. And
I mean, it's what's interesting to me is we, especially from the U.S. context. Like I wrote my little pamphlet. I was a teenage anarchist, and I started with the American context of hardcore, which is, in my opinion, a derivative off of what young Americans are seeing out of the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've heard, and you know, it's hard to even hear this music because it wasn't necessarily legal. Like it was super underground. Like we think stuff is underground here. It's like, no, it was really underground. So how does it even infiltrate so people can even hear it? Because there's nothing like it in the Soviet Union at this time. We have no internet at this time, and there is a massive divide culturally, to say the least, between the capitalist West and the USSR. So how are young people even hearing anything like this or able to hear it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it it lands us in chapter one in my book, which is about the beginning of punk in the Soviet Union, which occurs in Leningrad / St. Petersburg, whatever. And, you know, if you know the map of the Soviet Union, you know that St. Petersburg / Leningrad at the time is considered Russia's window to the West. It's on the Baltic Sea. But that also means that it's the closest to the Western border of the Soviet Union. It's very close to the Baltic states, which have more easy access to the West. And it also means that it's easier to intercept radio transmissions in St. Petersburg than it would be in Moscow or anywhere in the Far East. So the book begins with this character. His name is Svin. Andrei Panov is his name. And I sort of consider him to be the progenitor of punk in the Soviet Union. And a lot of people, most of the people that I interviewed from this period were willing to admit that, yeah, Andrei / Svin, we'll call him Svin from now on, which means pig, he was the first guy. And the reason that he was able to do it is there are two ways. The first one is that his family was what you could consider a Soviet cultural bourgeois, I guess. His father lived in Israel and his mother was a ballet dancer. I think, dancer or instructor. And so they had some money. Their father would send money home once in a while. But that also meant that Andrei was not very liked in school. People considered him and his family to be traitors because his dad had immigrated to Israel. But he still had money and he had a good sound system. And he could go to black markets in Leningrad, which, as I said, because it's closest to the border, people could kind of smuggle in records, or they could smuggle in any other kind of recordings. And through those black markets, he could find some things. And one thing that he found after 1977, I think 1978, was a Sex Pistols record. I'm not clear which one. I don't know if it was
Never Have Bullocks,
and I don't know if it was one of the demos, but it was what he found, right? And the way that, because he died in the 90s, the way that the people around him understood was that, you know, these kids would go to the black market and they would look for the coolest covers. Not like cover songs, but like the coolest looking artwork on the records.
I mean, is that any different? I don't know if you're old enough to remember record stores, but is that any different than us?
I still got record stores today, and I still do that. I go to record stores and I look at who's got the most original artwork, you know? Sometimes you're upset. Sometimes you get the most original artwork and you listen to it and you're like,
trash.
Oh, this is shit.
Yes. Yeah, but, oh, dude, there was, I won't get into it now, but yeah. Yeah, but that's interesting. They're just trying to find artwork in the black market. So I'm assuming they're paying, if they have the money, way more for these smuggled imports, right?
Yeah, and that's why it takes Sven, like I said, from a very particular socioeconomic background to be able to buy these things, bring them home, and then gradually he, you know, invites friends over to his house to start listening to the records, and then one of his friends, this individual, Yevgeny Yufit, who some people might know as the progenitor of the film genre called necrorealism. Yevgeny Yufit is friends with Sven, and he listens to the Sex Pistols and stuff, and he says, these guys, you can do what these guys are doing. Like, they don't know how to play anything, right? And so Sven takes that serious. He's like, yeah, you're right. You know, I can pick up a bass or something like that and just start jamming. And so he does, and he invites his friends over, and they start a band. They call it Automatichesky Udoletritny, which means the automatic satisfiers, which is a play on the name the Sex Pistols.
Interesting. And there's another thing that I saw. There's a cool little documentary series, I think it's called like Bandsplaining or something. Mm-hmm. And they talk about this in two parts. And one of the things they said was that as the late 60s and 70s were rolling around and rock music was slowly starting to infiltrate as well, there was like approved bands that had to sing these messages. But those bands were allowed to have like electric instruments. So electric instruments are flowing in as well.
Yeah, well, I'll get to the approved bands, because Sven kind of kicks off this this process in Leningrad, and Viktor Tsoi, who you have pictured in the, in the thing, he's one of these guys. He's friends with Sven, and he's actually, his first band is Automatichesky Udoletritny. He plays bass for them, but then he goes off and he does his own thing. But there's also people that are amassing around these proto musicians that are around Sven that are listening to his records and enjoying them. And another one of these individuals is this character, Fyodor Lavrov, Fedi Lavrov. And Fedi, he's considered the first anarcho-punk of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
He's younger than the rest of the guys. And so he's kind of like the outcast of them. And he decides, you know, I'm going to go and record my own stuff. So he ends up by the 80s, the early 80s, writing his own music as well that is more explicitly political. But the youth in Leningrad, there's obviously an interest in rock music that is emerging, that the authorities figure better to control this than to let it kind of devolve into illegal activity, right? If we could get a handle of it, if we can control the distribution, the access to it, then that's better for us. And so the authorities in Leningrad, they approve of an institution called the Leningrad Rock Club. This is in 1980, I believe, is when they approve it. And they put at the helm of the rock club, of course, it's staffed by KGB members, for one.
Interesting. But
it's also staffed by established rock personalities. So anybody who knows Russian or Soviet rock music, you might have heard the band Akvarium. Boris Grebenshikov, he's the singer. He's this kind of like Tom Petty of the Soviet Union, right? He's put on the board of members that have to approve bands that are admitted into the rock club. The rock club serves as a sort of union, I guess, for Leningrad rockers. And at first, Sven and company are absolutely denied access to the Rock Club because punk music is just, they don't know how to play, they're unprofessional. And another element, another thing that they were required to do is, in order to get access to play in the Rock Club, you had to submit your lyrics. The lyrics were read by a board of about five members. Again, you know, three of which, maybe four or all five, are working for the KGB at the same time. And that's their way of policing what gets public access. So Sven and them are not allowed in the Rock Club at first. Most of Sven's lyrics are about, you know, living a dirty life and smelling bad. And, you know, you can look up videos of him where he's got his pants half down and he's on stage and stuff like that. It's very like Sex Pistols-esque, right? It's all parroting that. Fetty, at the same time, he's younger, remember, he applies to work to go in the Rock Club, and they say, you're too young, you're too new, you should go, keep practicing, apply again, come back. So, you know, if anybody told that to you or me when we were 15, we would have said, fuck you. You know, I'm never coming back here. You
that's what Fetty does. I still say that to this day.
Fetty gets that rejection. He goes and he gets his friends and he records his own music under the name Hotel Samoeskorenenia, which means the Self-Eradication Department, or the Department of Self-Eradication, which is a hyper, very, very political band. The lyrics, one of the lyrics in the songs is Reagan and Andropov fucked all of Europe from behind. Right. And
so, wow.
So the lyrics are very, very politicized, more than any other band in this Leningrad milieu of music. And this is in the early 80s. At the same time, some people might know of punk bands that emerge in Siberia. Gryzdanska Oborona, for example, is one of them. Civil Defense from Omsk, Novosibirsk. There's this whole Siberian punk movement that is also starting, that is probably even more explosive than the Leningrad guys, in the sense that there's a whole diversity of bands. They develop their own network of shows and you know, in movement. And they are spearheaded more or less by this individual, Yegor Letov, who is also very political. And he manages to kind of mass produce tapes of his band, Gryzdanska Oborona. I don't know the exact number, but let's say that it's 100. And that's a lot for an individual to just keep copying, and he distributes them. And he comes under the radar of the KGB. And so the rumor is that he is on the run constantly, right? Because he doesn't want to get caught. That's the rumor anyway. But he's based in Siberia, so that's another kind of thing. So the Rock Club exists throughout the 80s. Eventually, Sven and Automatijski Udalet Ritni, eventually they get access into the Rock Club. And as the Soviet Union inches closer to collapse, the membership, the restrictions of the Rock Club are loosened up, which is a kind of interesting phenomenon. So that's sort of the beginning of the process, the pro-generation, I guess, of punk in the Soviet Union. There's a lot of great bands that come out of Leningrad. As I said, you had, I believe, Kino featured as the image here. Svoj comes out of this whole image. And in Siberia. But the weird thing about Siberia is Yegor Letov, who's very political, who's on the run from the KGB, when the Soviet Union collapses, he becomes one of the leaders of what's called the National Bolshevik Party, which is a Nazi communist party. So we could talk about the weird.
Let's put a pin in that one, because I do want to get back to that. Yeah.
We can talk about that in a minute, but
I mean, I think a lot of punk music at a certain point devolved into Nazi adjacent or just straight up Nazi stuff, especially after 84.
Yeah.
But we'll again, we'll
the
put
part,
a
The thing that's so wholesome about this period, this late Soviet period, and their access is just hearing the stories of these the characters that are still alive and how they discovered punk music as a sound. So Fetty's a good example. Fetty didn't hear punk through Sven. He heard it on his own. Most Russian households at the time, you lived with your like kind of extended family, right? Your grandparents lived with you because they were usually the caretakers. And Fetty told me that every Friday evening, his grandmother would go up to the roof of the building with a radio interceptor, right? And she would intercept BBC radio transmissions of the news because she wanted to hear how the West was, you know, what was happening in the West and how they were reporting it. And he would go up there and listen to her. And he said, after a certain time, the news would stop and then the music would come on. And he's like, and I stayed for the music. That's why I was there. And so the first band that he remembers hearing and being like, holy shit, what is this? Was the Boomtown Rats.
Oh, wow.
He said that they came in through BBC radio and he was like, what is this sound? You know what I mean?
I've only heard a little bit of the approved music because it's easier to find. Let's just be honest.
Yeah.
You know, even trying to find images or performances of this stuff is extremely rare because it was so underground. To that point, what restrictions were put on rock and punk music, and how did musicians, you know, even learn how to play? And did anyone get imprisoned during this time?
Okay, a few questions here. Starting with restrictions, the obvious restrictions are the lyrics cannot be politically offensive in any way, which is why, again, Sven was declined at first. You also had to have a level of professionalism. The rock club didn't want to accept anybody who they deemed as like unprofessional or unworthy of
being. Is it safe to say that the people that were beyond just the KGB people that were there, but is it safe to say that their first glimpse of punk music, what maybe they're seeing through whatever news outlets is, this isn't something that we
want. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You can imagine it's almost, I mean, I'm trying to think of like a Western analogy that you would appreciate, but it's almost like if, who's the singer of Creed? What's his name? Scott Stapp. Yeah. You can imagine if he's at like the head of a board of approval for bands to enter into the only venue that bands are allowed to play. You can imagine that his,
I wouldn't even go that far. I'd say, what if, you know, Keith Richards was not a fan of punk music.
Maybe because Boris from Agvarium is a little bit, I mean, he is sort of Russian rock's poster boy at the time. He is more or less approved as well. I mean, Agvarium can be played on radio and stuff like that. But he's sort of at the forefront of accepting these bands and whether or not they come. And honestly, his opinion also doesn't really matter all that much. What matters is if these secret police members want to say no. And most of the time they do. And even when they don't, Fetty and other people who remembered going to Leningrad Rock Club shows remembers distinctly that there were always awkward people standing there in the back, you know, dressed really nice. They weren't young rockers, right? They weren't somebody's parents, mm-hmm. but they were there in the back and they were observing what was going on. And at the time, these kids didn't understand that this is very much the party, right? This is very much the local government trying to keep a lid on this youth movement that's bubbling up, to control it. Better to control it than to let it go.
Do you think there's a fear of youth movements because the Soviet Union is able to put a handle on the teenage thing, right? Because that's a US concept, right? So that doesn't even exist in this world.
Yeah,
in the 50s and 60s. But the anti-war US Do you think that is the fear? That they're like, look, we can't have all these hippies and we can't have these hippie punks. We have to put a pin in this now.
Well, there's a sense, particularly with music coming from the West, that it promotes bourgeois ideals. Some of your listeners, and maybe even you, have seen that image of KGB labels that they put on certain Western bands. It was kind of making the internet earlier, but I have it up here. So, for example, Black Sabbath, they blacklisted Black Sabbath because it promotes violence and religious obscurantism. Pink Floyd was interfering in the foreign policy of the USSR in Afghanistan. Talking Heads were banned because they promoted the myth of Soviet military danger. The Sex Pistols promoted punk and violence. B-52s, punk and violence. Madness, punk and violence. So they were very much watching AC/DC, neo-fascism and violence, Judas Priest, anti-communism and racism. Tina Turner, sex. Van Halen, anti-Soviet propaganda, etc. You can go down the list. And so they're very much watching these Western bands, and they're seeing that there are dangerous messages embedded within the songs. And I'm kind of opening up a rabbit hole here with your listeners, because now you're going to go back and you're going to listen to some of those songs and you'll be like, damn, they were right. Like, there is fear of, I mean, listen to the Talking Heads song, what's it called, about war.
Jesus, I don't know.
I forget the name of the song, but, Life in Wartime, right? The Soviets could easily consider that promoting the threat of a Soviet military danger. And so you go back and you listen to this stuff now, and after learning this, and you're like, damn.
It's funny because the only juxtaposition you can have to that is the PMRC that happens in about 84, right? Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife, and her crew of Capitol Hill wives that go out and want to censor music, and they're trying to censor more so rock music with their sex and drugs lyrics. So there's the moral censorship that you have in the United States. We're not really worried about anti-war songs.
Right.
Which is funny when you think about, you know, the anti-war movement. Like, nah, we're not going to censor any of these songs that are looked at as like, oh, these are the songs of a generation. And the Soviet Union is like, dude, we're going to censor all this anti-Soviet stuff.
They're not dangerous in the United States in the same way that they could be in the Soviet Union for inculcating this kind of anti-Soviet, anti-communist, and pro-Western obsession, which is something that does happen, right? These musicians, the case of Sven is the perfect example, that it's the image of the Sex Pistols that he sees, and he's like, yes, this is what I want, right? And that, it's offensive to this kind of conservative Soviet culture, communist conservative culture that sees all this stuff as bourgeois decadence, promoting like immorality and bad value judgments. But there is some truth to it. Now, the thing is that in the Soviet period, the Leningrad Rock Club is really the only place. Moscow doesn't even have its corollary. Leningrad is the place. And to this day, St. Petersburg is still the artistic capital of Russia. But that it becomes the sort of institution of rock, I guess, so you could say. And punk, in its limited form, is permitted there towards the end of the Soviet period. There's some other bands that emerge within this period. Narodne Opolchenie is another one. People's Militia, People's Defense, or something like that. Objekt Nasmieshik is another one. Object of Ridicule is another one of their name. So some of these bands, especially towards the later part of the 80s, 86 and on, after Perestroika and Glasnost are emitted into the rock club. And again, I think that that's more so the party and the administration in Leningrad recognizing that, okay, now we have Perestroika and Glasnost. Now we have to kind of emit.
Can you explain real briefly what that means for the Soviet people and what Glasnost was? I know it's a lot, but can you just give the Cliff Notes version? Is that too much to ask?
Yeah, Glasnost meant simply openness. It was a willingness on the part of Gorbachev's cabinet, Gorbachev, to this belief that Soviet culture had fallen behind. It wasn't keeping up with the West, and it was obvious. It was very evident. I mean, say what you will about the Soviet Union, if you like it or hate it, there's no denying that by 1986, most Soviet people were the limited pictures that they got of the West, or even Westerners coming to the Soviet Union, they were wondering, why do these people have dryers and we don't? Why do they have blue jeans and we don't? Why do they have bubble gum? Why are they allowed to chew bubble gum, but we can't, right? And these things, they seem very, very irrelevant and ephemeral to us. But when there's enough of them stacked on top of each other, you start to ask why, you know?
Do you think that had a lot to do with the fall of the Soviet Union? Like some people make the joke that, not joke, but kind of maybe a mild tongue-in-cheek statement that it's the Pizza Hut commercial that Gorbachev does.
The Pizza Hut commercial came after the collapse.
It was after, right?
But most people don't recognize that, right? Because everybody loves to hate Gorbachev. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna get the wrath of some of your listeners, and especially the Stalinists, but I'm not anti-Gorbachev. I think that Gorbachev was responding to very real concerns that were present in the Soviet Union. And so I think that when it came to Glasnost in particular, or you asked, did it contribute to the collapse? Insofar as not having access to these things prepared the Soviet people, especially the younger generation, to bigger critiques of the Soviet Union and to communist ideology, right? The fact that culture couldn't keep up, the Soviet Union didn't collapse because its culture was behind. The Soviet Union collapsed because the people started to realize that the culture was behind, and then they found the systemic reasons of why it was behind. And they latched on to these nationalist explanations of it, right? So we can explain why the Soviet Union is behind because the Baltic states in Central Asia are holding Russians back from our true economic potential. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Soviet Union collapsed, right? It's not necessarily the cultural dynamic, but it plays a major role in informing critiques of the Soviet Union. And that's why somebody like Yegor Letov joins the National Bolsheviks after the collapse, because a lot of these people, they are not really anti-communist. I wouldn't say that they're anti-communist. They're on board for Yugoslavian term for socialism with a human face, right? They want access to this culture. They want to feel like they're engaging with world culture in a real way that's not heavily guarded and policed.
That's kind of romantic in a sad way whenever I think about this time and these people doing this music, because I always think about, you know, the freedoms, as corny as it's going to sound, that you have to make whatever you want to make here, and, you know, kind of watching these documentaries and reading a little bit of the history. And, you know, definitely didn't, you know, do as yourself. I mean, Alex didn't say this, but he actually went to the Soviet Union and did interviews. You were in the archives too, didn't you?
I was in Russia. I did interviews from 2014 until right up until I was done with the manuscript, 2018, and then I submitted it out to Microcosm. But yeah, the book is an oral history, so it's made up of interviews. I thought that as a Westerner, it was more important for the voices of the people that participated in it to be out than it was for my analysis or my interpretation. Because
but what written history is there for this moment? Because let's talk a little bit about the music. You know, we have something in this, in the Western world, that was definitely big as metal and punk are starting to become more popular in the later in 70s throughout the 80s, which is tape trading. And there were magazines, mainly out of the UK, English-speaking magazines like Metal Hammer and stuff like that, Kerrang, Circus, Rip, for all the old people watching the show that remember these magazines, where there were little parts in the back and the like classifieds where people said, hey, I'm looking for music from the Bay Area. So if you have any Bay Area thrash, you know, here's my address, and I'll send you whatever I got here in London or Germany. And I actually know someone. You met her, Connie. She's, you know, she's older than us, and she has friends that actually came to visit her when she was in the States from tape trading. But there isn't tape trading in the Soviet Union. They're pressing music on X-rays, and there's no sleeve. You don't know what you're getting. Talk about the phenomenon of the X-ray
album. Yeah, the bone records, as they're called.
They're
a little bit before this time. There's a kind of hipster movement that develops in the Soviet Union after the death of Stalin. It's called the Stilyagis. It literally translates to hipsters. And these are people that were because, you know, with Khrushchev, there's a limited opening of Western culture, and Western people can come into the Soviet Union for the first time after Stalin's death. And so there's some exposure to new rock music, right, in the 1950s, as well as kind of older forms that weren't older forms of music that weren't really fully developed, like swing music. It existed in Russia and in the Soviet Union, but not they didn't have as much access to it. So the Stilyagis are listening to some of this Western music, and they want it for their home. But the Soviet Union doesn't have a vinyl pressing plant at the time. It doesn't exist. They didn't build one. And so they start pressing this music on X-rays that are kind of discarded and sold that way. You can still find some of them at black markets. They now, because everybody knows about them, the dealers, the secondhand dealers in Russia have like marketed them up as like, you know, novelties. But you still see them around. But by the late 1970s and 1980s, under Brezhnev in particular, it's kind of recognized as a problem that there's this whole black market of music that exists that we need to get a handle on, because otherwise it's just going to continue feeding into this black market. And so they create the state music companies like Melodia. They build the record pressing plant, and they start pressing Western bands, Western music, but in a very curated form. So actually, if you give me a second, I can go get one of these.
You have one?
Yeah, I could show it to you.
Yeah, definitely. Here, let me take
it. I can go run and get it. Just hold on.
Oh, yeah. No, this is actually really fascinating, because also, you know, people have to keep in mind that, again, music artists have to be approved to record in these state-sponsored recording studios. So it's not legal to do like off-hours recordings even. For your own side project, which is, you know, such common practice in studios. So when Alex gets this, I'm actually really stoked to see it, because it is, imagine a used X-ray and they pressed music on it. And one of the things that the government did was they would press their own, because this is all black market. And again, you don't know what you're getting, right? Imagine. I can't even think. This is so beyond even my comprehension to just have someone be like, it's music, you'll like it. You know, it's being recorded in some crazy archaic way. B, I have no idea what I paid good money for. You know, C, how do I even play it, right? I was going to have to explain how these things got played. And sometimes the government would intercept them and record over them. So let's just say you were trying to get one of the hot bands and someone's like, dude, I got the, you know, new hot Russian, you know, Russian Sex Pistols. I got it. I got it. You're going to love it. And you get it and you put it on and you hear like four bars of Russian Sex Pistols. And then you hear a KGB agent go, you thought you were going to get good sounds. This is the government. Stop listening to this music. I'm like, whoa, that is gnarly. So, you know, that's an interesting part of this history. You know, it's not just the people that are fighting to make it. It's even the people that are fighting to be in the scene just to get it. You know, think about the ubiquitous nature of music in 2024. It's everywhere, right? We don't really value it. And I don't want to get too much into that, but making the effort to listen to whatever you can that isn't the approved stuff. So on your camera thing, Alex.
Yeah.
You can flip it around so it's not backwards on the screen.
Is it backwards on the screen?
It's also in Russian, so it doesn't really matter, I guess.
I don't know how to flip it.
You have to go into the settings and then go to video. And then go to mirror camera.
Oh, the MacBook settings?
Nope. On the bottom.
Oh, settings, video.
Mirror camera.
Mirror camera. There you go.
Yeah.
Here you go. You know who this is?
It's David Bowie, isn't it?
Hell yeah. It's a Melodia. Wait, there it is. Melodia Records David Bowie album.
Mm-hmm.
Pressed in, this is 1989 was when this one was pressed. So again, it's a very, very curated presentation of Western music once it's sort of started to be allowed into the Soviet Union. I don't have a Bone record. I used to have one. I don't know where it went. They're so thin that it's like lost in my record collection.
They disintegrated. I know a bunch of them disintegrated over time, apparently.
Yeah, they don't work. You can't use it. I can't.
So how are they playing it? The record players existed, I'm assuming.
They have the what are they called? The ones with the big speaker.
Phonographs?
Yeah, you can put it on there.
They were using phonographs in the Soviet Union in the 60s and 70s?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Alex is afraid to invert the camera because it might turn his anti-Hitler stuff. Right.
But that, like, while you were gone, I was talking about, like, the effort people made to get music just to hear something. Like, this is just the effort people are making just to hear anything.
Yeah. But it's not like they're it's a society devoid of music. It's just that they, you know, imagine just having the music that your state approves. If I had to listen to the music that Joe Biden likes, I would probably shoot myself. You know, I don't want to listen to that.
People always want to go like, oh, I think I found this better way to do stuff on Spotify. What if the state did this? I was like, do you really want the state involved in music, dude? You don't want the state involved in music.
Having the state involved in a thing like Spotify, maybe, but in regulating like who gets on Spotify and who doesn't, no, I wouldn't want that.
I mean, that was the whole thing about Spotify that's becoming a problem for Spotify. Sites like Pandora, you had to get approved to get on Pandora. And anybody could get on Spotify. And then they, you know, of course, it got big. They got bought up by Facebook. They blocked that. Now you got to go through a distributor. I'm not going to get into all that. But, you know, I like the fact that anyone can put out a record, even if it sucks.
Yeah. I mean, it does saturate the music a little bit.
Oh, definitely.
Which actually, to bring it back to the Soviet case, I mean, the limited supply of punk also is one of those things that made it extremely appealing to young people in novel, right? It's not an oversaturated market. It's new. You also asked the question of whether or not anybody got arrested. Fetty's story is actually really, really interesting. And there's a whole chapter of it in the appendix of my book, which was guest written by our good friend Tommy. It's called Fuck the Legacy, Life as a Soviet Punk Dissident, written by Tommy Dean. Because Tommy and I interviewed Fetty together, because Fetty was such an interesting dude. He still writes music. He lives in France. He's an emigre now. He fled Russia when the Ukraine war started. That's when he had enough. And he's been going through years of therapy just to get over the trauma of living in the Soviet Union and then in Russia, according to him.
Wow.
But he's, like I say, he's younger than the rest of these guys in the 80s. He's more politically bold and daring. He's not from a bourgeois family in the same way that Sven is. But he does have some access to instruments. He starts to gather stuff around him as he can, and then bringing friends in to jam with him to try to, like, you know, churn out some tapes, some tape recordings. And like I said, I quoted one of the lyrics, Reagan and Andropov fucked all of Europe from behind. You know, a song called Military Monarchy. Very, very politically dissident lyrics. And so he makes these tapes. He makes about five of them. He distributes them to his friends, and there's artwork in them and everything. You know, this is a real deal. And to this day, I think he's the only one that has a copy of this tape somewhere. And he said he doesn't know how exactly it happened, but he said that he believes that one of the friends that he gave the tape to gave it up to the police. And he thinks he knows who it is, but he didn't want to name anybody. But he's like, I know who it was. And so they called him in. He came in. And they asked him all these questions about, the way he was describing it was like the classic, you know, two interrogators with the light over him.
Damn.
And he was like, and they were asking me these questions like, do you play music? Yes. Well, what do you write about? Well, I just write about life and all that stuff and blah, blah, blah. And they were asking him these questions and letting him answer. And then finally, they took out his tape with the lyric sheet and everything. And they said, you want to explain this to us? I gotcha. Mm. And it was given to us by one of your friends that you personally gave it to. So he's fucked at that point, right? He had been, before this, he had been picked up off the street for wearing a shirt that on one side had a swastika and on the back side had a hammer and sickle, and it said, no country for fools, something like that. So the police already know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's no mystery that he's a dissident, but he's young. He's a little troublemaker. But this was a big deal, right? Because now he's making anti-Soviet content and he's distributing it. So they make him sign a contract. This is in 1987, I believe, mm-hmm. or 88. They make him sign a contract that says he will never play music in the Soviet Union again.
Jesus.
He signs it. He's got nothing else he can do. And on top of that, they draft him into the military.
Good times.
He goes into the military, and he's non-compliant, right? He's a non-compliant military person. And so, you know, usually when you had people like that in the Soviet military, they couldn't really do much with you, so they just got rid of you, usually by saying that you suffer from a mental disorder. And so he's discharged with schizophrenia. He is sent to a mental institution where he's in the mental institution. The way that he described it to me is, I was helping the patients that were actually mentally disturbed. He's like, I became like one of the employees there because these people are neglected by staff. And he's like, and I'm there and I was taking care of people. And it became really clear to everyone that that I wasn't schizophrenic. And he told me that one day the head of the hospital called him in and they said that they were releasing him all of a sudden. He had no idea why. He's like, I don't know what happened, but he suspects that his mom had something to do with it. He suspects that his mom bragged the institutional warden or whatever they're called to let him out. So he gets out eventually. But as long as the Soviet Union is there, he can't write music, and he doesn't. As soon as the Soviet Union collapses, Fetty starts writing again. He gets a new project. It's not punk. After that experience, he's done with punk until I start researching this book, which is another story. I kind of inspired him to re-release the old songs.
Aww.
Play. But he's done with punk throughout the 90s and then the early 2000s. He doesn't want anything to do with it. Now he lives in France. He's in a new band called Floor is Lava. So if you're interested, you can look up Fetty. Or just if you follow me on Instagram, I can send you the page too. It's pretty good. He sings in English and he has sort of the broken accent, but he's doing what he can. His story is absolutely bizarre, but you know, I guess that's what it takes to be the first anarcho-punk in the Soviet Union.
That's a hell of a title to have. Speaking of Russia. You went back, going back to Russia and did more interviews post the pandemic lockdowns. And what was your documentary about? It was a little different. It was still about punk, but it was about a new wave of punk musicians that have been displaced.
Yeah, I went to Georgia. So the book that I wrote, it's not just about the Soviet period. I go all the way up to 2015. There's an evolution in Russian punk history. Because this history that I was just describing, it's very centered in Leningrad, right? After the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's an explosion of punk that happens in the capitals, in Moscow in particular. Naive, somebody mentioned a band that was on MTV in the 80s. Well, Naive is the first Russian punk band that's picked up by Maximum Rock and Roll and kind of blasted. And I have that record that Maximum Rock and Roll put out.
Oh, wow.
I think, when is this? From 19... Yeah, it still says USSR on it. It's kind of the beginning of commercial punk. Naive sounds a lot like Green Day. And all of that, right? The Moscow punk is really defined by this effort to try to make money from punk. Leningrad doesn't have that. And even when it becomes St. Petersburg again, there's really no commercial impetus in punk in the cultural capital.
Where does Pussy Riot come to be?
There's a chapter in the book about Pussy Riot as well.
Because you're not a big fan of Pussy Riot, right?
It's not that I'm not a fan of them. It's that when I was interviewing punks in 2014, 15, and 16, I always asked them about Pussy Riot because I had started doing interviews for the book before Pussy Riot did their big protest in the church in Moscow. But then after that, I started asking people, like, what do you think about them? And everybody had more or less the same answer. The answer was, I've never seen these women before. We don't know who they are. They're not of this punk scene at all. But we respect what they did, I guess, right?
They were like art students, right?
Yeah, they're an art
collective, would you call them?
That takes the label of punk and uses that as a symbol of dissidence, I guess, is a way to put it. The book ends around 2015. The last interview I did was in 2018. But officially the date, the ending of the book is 2015. And I considered that when I was done, I was like, I'm done with punk, dog. Like I wrote the book on Russian punk. I've given my heart and soul into this book, into punk. This is my thank you to the international punk movement. I'm done with it. And then this fucking war started. And I, of course, all these people that I interviewed that I got really close to, I'm still close to them. I still follow what they're doing, and they're still curious about what I'm doing, right? And to some extent, people like Fetty will be like thankful to me for the rest of his life for bringing his story out, and helping in that way. And so I was keeping tabs on what was happening with everybody, as not just as the war broke out, but as Putin's mobilization order was issued. And all of these dudes that I interviewed, particularly in St. Petersburg, were either already in Georgia or they were fleeing to Georgia. They were getting the hell out of Russia, right? They didn't want to be drafted because they're all draft age. They're all of the age to be drafted into the military. Some of them did get draft cards. And so a friend of mine messaged me a video from this place called Secret Place in Tbilisi, Georgia. And she was like, look at all these people that you know, all these Russians that are here. She's like, it's crazy. And I was like, yeah, this is like a massive punk exodus, right? That I've never seen the likes of before. And somebody should document it. She was like, yeah, you should write another book about it. And I was like, you know what? Like, I don't think I like, you know, the book was cool, and I don't know how many copies were sold, but I was like, I don't want to write a book about this, because I don't think you could really offload enough copies of a book that is about Russian punks leaving Russia to go to Georgia. You know what I mean? I could think mm-hmm. of like 10 people that would actually buy that book.
Exactly. It's very niche.
But I was like, a movie? If I could direct a movie, put together a movie somehow, then, you know, people who are even passively interested would be like, hey, why not? You know, it's an hour. I'll take the time.
I mean, we made a trailer while you were here.
Yep.
And we got hella stoked making that. Well, I did. I can't speak for you. I was getting pretty stoked making that trailer.
I did. Yeah. I mean, everything that's come together for it has been exciting, because you can probably hear from just me talking. My favorite medium is written, right? I'm not a good talker. I don't like the sound of my voice. My favorite medium is definitely writing. It's where I can communicate the most. And that's a plug for my Substack. but for me, it was like, okay, I don't want to take the time to write this book, because it also takes like 2 years for a book to be published, to be actually printed and distributed. And I was like, and you know, a lot could change in 2 years. The war could be over by that time. So I was like, what if I get to Georgia, take a whole bunch of footage, and then do what I did with the book, right? With the book, I had a pile of interviews. I have a binder of them still somewhere, but not in here. I had a pile of interviews, over 100 interviews, that to begin sitting down, being like, I'm going to start this book. I broke the interviews up into epochs, into decades, right? Mm-hmm. This is the 70s, this is the 80s, this is the early 90s, this is the late 90s. It kept going like that. And then I was like, okay, now one by one, I'm going to go through each epoch, reading the interviews, finding the common threads, finding like the interesting stories, and then put them together, cut them out, literally cut them out, put them together, and try to form a narrative based on what these people are saying. So I was like, what if I did that with a movie, right? With recorded interviews and you know, B-roll footage. And so that's what I've come to do. And, you know, the movie is almost fully complete. We're very close. The premiere of the movie is May 3rd in Providence. Then it's going to be, then I'm going to Europe in June to show it. And then it's going to be streaming on Right Brain TV, which is a kind of new streaming platform. And they're going to have it for 2 months. And then after that 2 months, it's going to go on YouTube. That's kind of the plan right now. And the only people that have seen it is Tyler, who's doing the editing, because, you know, I can I made this sort of storyboard where the clips are, and I'm in charge of saying, like, aesthetically, this looks like shit. Aesthetically, this looks cool. Maybe you should try doing this. So I'm directing in that way. But Tyler is the powerhouse of editing, and that dude has been working fast and working well. He's based in LA. So he's seen it, obviously, because he's working on it. I've seen where we're at now, and then the dudes from Right Brain have seen a version of it. And so I'm excited for everyone else to see it, how it comes. And I kind of see it as, I guess, it's almost like an appendix chapter of this book, right? It's like the afterword. Mm-hmm. Because the name of the book is What About Tomorrow, right? Because there's this sense in throughout all the chapters of the book, throughout all the stories of Russia, of Soviet and then Russian punk, that, you know, things can get better. We just have to keep working for it. We just have to keep going. And every decade throws its new obstacles. In the 70s and in the 80s, you had the obstacles of Soviet control over the music industry. In the 90s, you had the obstacles of this bifurcation of the scene between neo-Nazis and, you know, politically apolitical people, right, that were just sick of politics in the 80s. By the early 2000s, you get a very strong, very coherent anti-fascist hardcore movement, right, which is necessary because Nazism, neo-Nazism had become such a political force in the early 2000s. So at every epoch, there's this sort of struggle, and everyone's, and they're all kind of pushing back, trying to carve out a place for the scene. And so the book was called What About Tomorrow, because it's an optimistic look. And then the name of the movie is Nothing Lasts Forever, right? Because now the new obstacle is these people, some of them who are in the book, forced to leave their country, you know? They don't want to return. They're ashamed of what Russia's doing, for better or for worse. I mean, that's the thing too, is like, I have my own political views on what's going on with Russia and Ukraine and how it's going to end up. But these Russian punks, people that I have interviewed, they have their own view, and I try not to get too political about it. Moscow Death Brigade, I interviewed some of the members of Moscow Death Brigade. They're in the book too.
So, you know, in closing, let me ask you this question. As a young person that grew up in a punk / hardcore scene in the northeastern part of the country, would you say what you came to find in the Soviet Union punk scene, or researching the Soviet Union punk scene, did it seem more hopeful than the nihilism that we had in the States, or do you think it mirrored it?
It's a hard question. I think that every decade of Soviet and Russian punk and hardcore is so different than what had existed, because the underlying socioeconomic and political changes had such an impact on what these people could express, who they were encountering, the venues that they could play in, how they could get music, how they could distribute it. I mean, the early 2000s up until from about 2000 to maybe 2008 are kind of seen as this zenith point, because you have both commercial punk, mostly in Moscow, bands like Tarakani, Naive, Distemper, and then you have the growth of like zines. Sad Wave is a major one that develops. You have the growth of what are they called? They're getting access to the internet, but they're also getting what is it called? Record labels that issue their catalogs, right? Mm-hmm. You're getting physical catalogs where, you know, some aspiring Russian punk can see an album by, I don't know, The Virus, and they can be like, this seems cool, I want this, and they can order it. They can send it off, and they can get copies back. So you start getting distros in Russia. These are people that are buying a lot of quantities of The Virus album, right, and then reselling it in Russia. And so the early 20s are seen as this kind of apex moment. But at the same time, there's a very real, very large neo-Nazi movement in Russia that is a danger to a lot of the people that like listening to punk and going to shows, but they didn't sign up for the violent aspects of it. You know what I mean? Like couples. There's some stories that the 2000s, I have a whole chapter. I have a whole chapter in this book on the anti-fascist movement, because there's an entire kind of decade where there are bomb threats that are called into shows. There are street brawls that happen, like groups of people just fighting each other, like war. And there has to be some kind of organized resistance to that thing. So is it optimistic? I think that, you know, the cool thing was interviewing members of or punks from different generations in throughout Russia's past 50 years history, and just seeing the different experiences that they all had. And then seeing, more importantly, how it's so related to political and socioeconomic conditions, right? Even if they don't understand it that way, you know?
Is there any bands you can recommend that we can find some of that old stuff? Or someone asked a question earlier, like, is there any of it around? I was like, good luck finding it.
A lot of it has been remastered and put up. So, for example, Fetty's band, Department of Self-Eradication or Self-Eradication Department, that he put it on Bandcamp, I believe. And maybe it's on Spotify too. I'm not sure. But he remastered those old tracks and then put them up. Some of it is really cool, and I think that a lot of the listeners will dig it. Russians are as much on Bandcamp, contemporary bands are as much on Bandcamp as any other country. Bands right now, I can't really recommend that many because I've been out of it since 2018, but I can say that in Georgia, there have been some really cool bands, but they show up and then they disappear. So like Funeral Mask, for example, is a cool band that developed. There's this awesome band, I think they're still around, from St. Petersburg called Ankulim. I have to write it out in order to spell it, but they're cool because they're like they're a blend of metal, punk, and like Russian folk. So they have like
an interesting. Bit.
I think it's A N K Y L Y M, and that is in St. Petersburg. And they're great. And their singer Ilya, he's a sociologist, and he wrote a book about Russian punk in the 90s because he grew up in the punk scene in the 90s, which is its own thing. So definitely worth checking out. You should check out some of the classic bands, like Tartakani, which is still a band that I have a love hate with them, really, because they are very much opportunists. They're one of those, they sound just like Green Day. They're one of those bands that's trying to make money off of punk, but you know, good for them, I guess. There is a lot of the Soviet era bands like Object of Ridicule. You might not be able to find. There's a record label that was also inspired by my book, Siyanye. I gotta spell it out again. My friend Bulyat. I think it's Seyane. But what he did was he was also inspired by my book. And so while I was finishing it, he started this kind of distro record label where he reached out to a lot of these old Soviet era bands and asked them for copies of their tape or their music of some sort so that he could remix it and then put out a compilation. So he did. He put out a compilation, and I think it's on Bandcamp, that has some of these old bands in it, which is pretty cool. I don't know where he is now. I think Bulat is also one of. He may be in Turkey now, But so yeah, there's a lot of cool bands. There's another great band that you can find YouTube videos of from the anti-fascist period, the early 2000s, and the name of their band is Pravolenchna Linenka, which literally means straight edge in Russian. It's translated directly. And they're great. They kind of remind me of like a
Minor Threat.
Yeah, but with an element of that like C squat sound. You know what I mean?
What the fuck is a C squat sound?
You know, the East Coast, the like choking victim / leftover crack sound.
Okay. You took me a while to realize you were naming bands and not sounds.
But yeah, they're pretty cool. You can find videos of them on YouTube. Another classic in the 90s period is Karoly Shoot, which means the clown and the the king and the jester. And they were probably the first famous punk band in Russia ever. They're playing sold out stadiums for the first time. They have this whole image, this like folkloric image. Most of their songs are about like Russian folklore and witches and shit like that. The singer died in the 90s, but the bass player, he's still alive and he lives in California. And his son, Kirill, is one of the people that opened the venue in Tbilisi.
Oh, really?
So actually, when I saw Kirill, because Kirill had been in the U.S. quite a lot. His dad is a U.S. citizen now. And he stayed with Tommy in the Bay when he was going through. So I asked Kirill, I was like, why don't you just move to the U.S.? Like, why are you staying in Georgia? He's like, that's my dad's life, man. Like, this is where my people are. This is where I want to be. I want to be with my friends. I don't want to be in the U.S. He's like, I might still get my U.S. passport now because I can, and it's probably good to have. But he's like, but I'd rather be here. He's got bands. He's one of those kids that's like so good at guitar that he's in like 6 different bands. You know what I mean? Like every scene has one of them.
This is a great comment. I have no idea who you guys are, but as an 80s kid, you had me at punk rock in the Soviet Union.
Oh yeah.
Well, you are tuning into This Is Revolution Podcast. So, podcast run by a real deal musician.
Thank you, Matt Osborne. The MA, is that, are you from Massachusetts?
Or are you a Masters of Arts?
Or yeah, are you a Masters in Martial Arts?
I hope you're both. I hope cool. You're a Massachusetts Martial Arts Master, Matt Osborne. But yeah, we do several shows on punk rock, and definitely tune in for April 30th when we're going to do was 1984 the greatest year for punk and metal. We go over all the releases of punk and metal in the year of our Lord 1984. That'll be a good time.
Oh hell yeah. Military history master's degree. That's cool. All right, guys in the chat, leave Matt alone. He just came here. Leave him alone. Don't go after him now. Everyone's like AOC. Everyone wants to jump on him now. Leave the poor guy alone.
Someone said, I never knew the USSR had punk rock. It's one of those things you never think about because you just assume these things are everywhere because there's such a global aspect of heavy music. Like when we do the show of what's the whole series we're doing, what's the greatest year of music, right? We've done 93, 79, and 84. Mm-hmm. And when I make the playlist, I literally try to put as much as I can globally. Mm-hmm. So it's just not US, it's not just domestic releases. That would be a 20 song playlist, right? Born in the USA, Purple Rain, Like a Virgin, you're like, oh yeah, 84 is the greatest year ever.
Right? Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff that was popular in Brazil, in Japan, in Mexico, in Argentina. So I try to put it all as much as I can. So there's like 100, all the playlists have 100 and some songs. But you think that this music is everywhere. Like 1984, you think, oh, where's the Russian stuff? It's like, oh, I don't know.
Not there.
I mean,
not there.
It wasn't officially released. This is all underground. Super.
Kino is really like the first band that comes out of this early 80s punk group. I don't even want to call it a scene. It's a punk group in Leningrad that like then does become something, something bigger that makes international waves. But that's sort of the reason, that's how I got interested in the topic to begin with. How I started researching it was I was in Nizhny Novgorod in 2012 doing a study abroad there. I was learning the Russian language there. And I think at the time I had like one or two tattoos, but they were evident, right? It was like wearing a t-shirt and you could see it. And some kid came up to me just randomly on the street and he was like, "You like punk rock?" And I was like, "Yeah, how did you know?" And he's like, "Well, you have tattoos and, you know, you're wearing black." And I just thought that, you know, I was like, "Yeah, you got me." And he's like, "Have you been to a punk show here yet?" And I was like, "Honestly, I didn't know that you guys had punk shows." I was like, "I know there's this place in Nizhny called the Rock Club, right?" And I would walk by there and I would hear like fucking Smash Mouth and shit blasting from the outside. So for me, it was like, I really want to go in there. It's not my crew, you know? But so he's like, "All right, Friday night, meet me here. We're gonna go to a punk show together. I'll show you some Russian punk.
I'll show you a good time."
And I was like, "All right, word." So this, I shit you not, this is a real story. So Friday comes, I go to the meeting place. It's dark out. It's getting dark out. It's like, you know, it's gonna be fully pitch black and 10 minutes. I'm waiting. I'm in the middle of nowhere, right? It's a bus stop, like outside the city. I'm waiting in the middle of nowhere. Finally, from across the field, I see some flashlights moving. And I was like, "What the fuck's going on?" Right? And this group of kids come up to me. One of them with the flashlight puts it in my face and he's like, "You the American?" I was like, yeah, I'm the American. And he's like, "You want to see punk rock?" And I was like, yeah, that's what I was told, come here. He's like, "All right, follow me." And so we walked for 45 minutes in a direction that I have no idea. I don't know where the fuck we're going, right? We're just walking. I don't know the city. I had only been there for about a month. I didn't know like the outskirts of the city that well. We're walking for like 45 minutes. We come across this kind of industrial / broken down zone, and there's two old like industrial buildings, old factories that are just completely abandoned and like fall decrepit, that's the word. And I see that there's an extension cord going from like somewhere far away into one of the buildings.
It's gonna be a great show if you see an extension cord powering a whole show. Gonna be a great show.
So I go in and the name of the band, if anybody wants to look it up, they're Party Breaker. They used to be based out of Nizhny Novgorod. Then they moved to Moscow. And I'm not sure if they're a band anymore, but you'll still be able to find their music. Party Breaker is their name. And so I go in. And this place, it's a decrepit factory. The beams on the wall, the big wood beams, are like hanging down. There's nails coming out of the floor.
Oh yeah.
The area in which the show is supposed to go on is no bigger than this, the room that I'm in right now.
Yep.
It's pretty small. And you know, I was drinking at the time. So I was, you know, throwing back, practicing my Russian with people, and you know, everyone's so fascinated because I'm an American and how the fuck did I find this place? I was like, "I don't know, man.
Are you here for the blood feast?"
Yeah, they led me with flashlights. I have no idea what I'm doing here. And so everyone's like, "Oh no, you're gonna have a blast." And so I go in, Party Breaker starts, in the foot, the place erupts. You got kids hanging on those wooden fucking beams that are hanging out.
Yes.
You got people moshing, and I'm sure like fucking up their feet on the nails that are sticking out. And I was like, this is coming from Boston. I was like, this is the most genuine punk that I had seen in my life. Like for real. I, you know, I, I was, you know, when 80s hardcore was a thing, I wasn't of age. So I didn't have that experience of seeing hardcore in its beginning in like a genuine sense. But I had, you know, seen punk in the 90s. I saw the Dropkick Murphys when they were still all skinheads and playing like, you know, underground places. But I had never seen something so genuine and so DIY before. And I had been to DIY shows in Boston. I've been to basement shows. I've been to like small venues and stuff. I'd seen that. But there in Boston, you get crowds that stand around like this all the time. Right? Maybe they're bobbing their head, but they've seen it all already. They've already seen everything, even by this period. So I'm here and Party Breaker starts and it fucking goes wild. And I get pushed around and I'm like, this hasn't happened to me in a long time. And I was like, this is cool. I want to talk to the band afterwards. And so after I did end up talking to the band, I didn't, at that point, I didn't know that I was going to write a book. So I wasn't doing like a formal interview, but I was just talking to them about like what it is, you know, what kind of scene exists here. And I was like, honestly, guys, I had no idea what that Russian punk was even a thing. And they were like, oh yeah, like, this is a small scene. And I was like, damn, all right, let's do it. Let's get into it. And then the next year I lived in Moscow and I got much bigger. I got exposed to Moscow's punk scene, which is a lot different. But I mean,
would you agree now that you, you know, you got a couple stamps on the passport and you saw like an underground scene somewhere else where they don't have the, a certain amount of, what's the word? What's a good word? I don't want to say spoiled. Oh, what's a good word? I've seen some crazy stuff in different parts of the world, right? Like shows where it's like, this is cool.
Yeah.
And we played some gnarly place in Brazil in 2019. And there was a dude, I don't know if he had a birth defect or what, but he was just kind of, he had arms and no legs. And he was going hard.
Yeah.
He was going hard when we played and he was like, just let me go on the floor. And he would just be like,
I think that in a lot of these places, punk has given people something to like really believe in and, and put their energy in a world that like doesn't really give them that much to commit to. And you might be able to make that same argument that like, that was the case in the 80s too, right? That there were a lot of people that really believed in it, that were committed to it. You meet them and they're autistic as fuck. And all they can do is talk to you about the coolest bands that are out there and like the equipment and the gear and all the stuff. They don't have a life outside of it. Right. Cause this is their life. And you meet that and you see that still in the US, but it's kind of like, it's not commercialized. I mean, I'm struggling to think of the same word that you are.
It's not just commercialization. There's something to your point. Okay. Let's break it down like this. Even you're from a major metropolitan area. I'm from a major metropolitan area. I don't care if someone's throwing an underground show or some sort of underground thing. There's a difference between an underground thing in LA or New York or Philly and an underground thing in Moscow, Idaho.
Yeah.
Because you, to your point, you've seen everything. Yeah. Every major artist is going to come through. Every aspiring artist is going to come through. You probably know some people that have made it, whatever the hell that means. Maybe your best friend's band played Warped Tour, whatever the hot thing is for people to play nowadays. When you don't have that at all, so those shows are different. They hit way different.
Yeah, that. So Connor said the quote that I said, that there's this feeling that we've seen it all already in the States. And I think that's it. That's the word that we're looking for. We're looking for a word that captures the sense in the US where everyone has this kind of like, I've seen it already position. And it makes them kind of indifferent. It like sucks the energy their enjoyment out of the music that they're watching, right? So now you're just kind of standing around with your arms crossed or awkwardly trying to figure out what to do with your arms, which is why, like, I don't really go to shows all that much anymore, because I don't know about you, but like when I was a kid, my sister and I would like, you know, we would learn the choreography from a Backstreet Boys song and then we would perform it for my mom, right? Mm-hmm. It was fun. And so now when I go to shows, that's all I see is like adults doing that with instruments in their hand. And it's really hard for me to like not see that. But when you go to a place like in Nizhny that I was just explaining and you see that, then you're like, oh, this isn't cosplaying music. This isn't cosplaying the scene anymore. Like this means something to everybody collectively in this room. And they all know each other. And they're all not socially grandstanding each other. They're all friends. They all love each other, right?
It's a beautiful dude. You didn't get a chance to do it because I think I was doing a show while you were here, and I don't know if there was anything going on because you kind of came, you know, during the week, right? But the scene in TJ, which you didn't get a chance to check out, which I found, is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah,
I saw a bunch of people of various ages, which I thought was also cool. It wasn't just kids. It was OGs. It looked like even their grandkids, skaters, taggers, punks, everybody moshing, helping each other up, loving the bands that are playing. A person helping facilitate that, which is really hard to do in a big city for a long period. There's a reason why when I have the OGs from like the metal and punk scene in the Bay Area, they give so much props to this one older black gentleman that owned a place called Ruthie's Inn. And if anybody listening is a fan of any of the Bay Area bands from Metallica, even the non-Bay Area bands like Slayer and Megadeth and Anthrax, even all those guys give Ruthie's Inn props because that's where they could play.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't a lot of venues that would allow it. That's another thing we don't talk about. There's not a lot of places in 2024. Most of these posters behind me, which aren't even that old, these venues are gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have posters just like that. I had to take them down because my last partner didn't like them, but I should put them back up now.
A woman I was dating actually did this. Shouldn't. Very nice of her to do that. But, you know, there's when we talk about scenes, it's hard to have a domestic scene because of that whole, like, as somebody said, desensitize, I'm over it vibe. Everybody's trying to get famous. When no one's trying to get famous because fame ain't nowhere near you, it's a whole different vibe in those spots when you play. And that's the one thing, it's one of the things that I miss about being a small band, having to tour in what's called a B market, is when you play those places where there no one's coming through.
Yeah.
You're miles away. You know, people forget, from Seattle East, if the next big show you play, if you don't go to Vancouver, which is still isn't that big of a show, is Minneapolis.
Yep.
Most people just fly to Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And we would play all these little bitty places, and some of those shows just went off because no one came.
Yeah, the Midwest is one of those like roll of the dice places. When you're going through the Midwest, you don't know if your show is going to be nobody, or you could even get a show where there's a bunch of people and you're like, how the fuck did this happen?
Yeah,
all it takes is one
I saved, like, yeah,
one I saved dude the poster with social clout. He just shared your flyer and everyone was like, yeah, let's do
and
it.
Everyone shows up. We did a show in Moscow, Idaho. It was our first time in Moscow. And we're at this dude's house and he was kind of like chilling. He was like doing blow with his girlfriend. And we're like, okay, we're supposed to be playing. And everyone said your house is supposed to be like this dope spot. And he's like, oh, don't worry, I'll text people. And he sent out a text message and there was just people overflowing in the house. It was like a Sunday. he had forgotten we were supposed to be there. It was one of those things. And then everybody shows up. The walls are sweating when we're playing. And, you know, that's something I miss. And I've been able to see it as an older person now. I'm 46, man. I'm not trying to, you know, ride the lightning like I was 10 years ago. But I really love seeing, you know, people find that communal bond. You know, as we talk about leftism on this show all the time, one of the things that I think it's really missing is a sense of community.
Yeah.
And there's something about those venues that we would go to. I'm still friends with people from music scenes I was in as a teenager. So
I think social media has changed the quality of community as well in certain ways. But I mean that sense of indifference or the sense that we had seen it everywhere, it exists in Russia too. That there are some bands that I interviewed from smaller towns like Ijevsk, for example. So great. One of my favorite Russian punk bands ever is from the town of Ijevsk. It's called Minefield. They have a band camp. Look that up. They were amazing. They were a phenomenon that existed for like a year, but they came out with a fucking boom and a bang, and people still talk about them. I'm still talking about them. And all their members kind of live different places now. But anyway, one of the members, Sasha, I was interviewing him, and he made that point. He's like, I like playing the smaller towns better because people are genuinely into what you're doing. And he's like, and then we go to Moscow and everyone doesn't care. Like, nobody gives a fuck what we're doing. We go to St. Petersburg and like people actually care what we're doing. But he's like, in Moscow, like you could get an audience. You get a room of 100 people, but no one's going to mosh. Everyone's going to feign like they don't give a shit because they've seen it, you know? So he's like, I like playing the smaller places better.
Oh, dude.
There's no money in it, though.
There's no money. there's no money. There was no money in us going to Juarez, Mexico, you know? But fuck. You know, the last time we were there, it was a room full of people. And we were like, whoa, they're here to see us. What did we do right?
Yeah.
Right? That's
when I was in TJ, we did go to that. We went to the bar, the club.
Oh, the bar. But you went in the day.
Yeah, we went in the day, so we didn't see a show or anything. But
there's shows there sometimes. But that bar is my favorite bar in the world.
Next time we're going to go. We'll see a show there.
Kushluk says, speaking of no money, when is there a TIR Mexico meetup? You know what's funny, Kushluk, that you say that? Like, I've been wanting to do a Mexico thing because, A, crossing the border, as Alex knows, is a bitch.
Yeah.
And there's some really cool places here that would actually let us do stuff. They would actually even let us do a show. So I don't know. It's just if you people tell me that you would come to this part of Mexico, then I would definitely do a TIR thing in Mexico.
And you can get Tommy's band to play Piss Mist.
I saw some video footage of Tommy playing.
Yeah.
I was so proud of him.
you get them to come down and play. It's cool. I'll bring my mini Korg, and I'll just do some weird synth shit, and we'll call it my sound project.
See, this is Anton says something real interesting, and we can riff on this for a while. Anton says, it's why the state needs to provide an income for art production, which is why I find the failure in USSR interesting. The state's also going to have to approve art production, and we have to be under the assumption that the state would approve a band like Two Live Crew, right? Swans, Anal Cunt. NWA.
Yeah. So the Soviet Union had like writers unions, and that was the rock club intended to be kind of like a musicians union, right? But in practice, it's a lot harder because, like Jason was saying, with certain like forms of art, you just get like if everyone's sort of allowed to do it, then you get just this proliferation of different genres that transcend like the time, right? That are looking beyond the time or looking backwards. And so I don't know, it can be kind of hard, I guess, for state officials to see what is genuine, you know, what is new, what is innovative, because they're looking at the present.
I mean, maybe you don't get what is that sexy red, right? Yeah. Maybe there's no sexy reds. You know, maybe there's no Drake. Maybe there's no Rakim.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's like, you know, I agree that the state should pay artists. But that means is that the state gets to decide who is an artist and who isn't. And what that means is that certain people are granted more resources to do their art and others aren't. And so devising a system for that to happen in an equitable way, and one that can embrace the diversity of artistic forms, musical sounds and lyrics and content and all that stuff, that's the hard part, right? That's the part that I think we as socialists need to be thinking about, that kind of stuff. We not need to be thinking about whether or not Lenin would agree if we should vote for president in 2000. You know, who gives a fuck about that? We need to be thinking of ahead of like, well, what do we want these systems to actually look like? Because once we figure that out, then that's what we can actually promote to people. Like, hey, you're a struggling artist. Did you ever think about the possibility of socialism doing this for you? You know?
Like, you know, people have mentioned Canada, and I know people that have gotten the Canadian grant, and, you know, it's more skewed than you think. It can be specific to certain ethnicities and genders, which, you know, I don't have a problem with. Again, I knew a band that got the grant and it was pretty cool. They got to tour, but their music was a little out there. It definitely wasn't for everybody. Actually, domestically, I know there's subsidized housing, or there was in New Orleans for artists if you could prove that like a majority of your income came from your art, which is pretty cool. Which, you know, that to me is more important than proving somebody, you know, making a record. Like, can you help somebody have housing? That's a big problem with, you know, music today. You know, there's no place where your rent's going to be a few hundred bucks a month and you can afford to figure out your sound. Like you know, all these weird bands you hear in the 80s and even 70s, they could, you know, work on their craft because their living expenses were affordable.
Yeah.
That's gone. Did you see this comment? What Alex described is just a record company.
Yeah, I mean, there's some truth to that, though. The difference is that record companies, because of the market in which they exist, they are incentivized by that market, right, to get what is the hottest thing, what's going to generate the most income for them. If you can take that profit incentive out, then maybe a record company is a good starting point, right? But rethinking about how record companies operate and how they justify signing the artists that they do, right? Taking the market out of it might be, you know, an option worth looking into.
Oh yeah, sometimes I'm amazed at some of the stuff I find. I played you that young lady I just found out of the UK. That music is so interesting.
Yeah. I still do find some interesting artists too. I mean, I'm at a point, like I said, I don't really go to shows all that much anymore, where I'm just kind of like musically jaded. In a lot of ways, that it's kind of like a hurdle that I have to overcome, I think.
Okay, when you come back down here, definitely we'll make sure that your trip is arranged around a show, because it wasn't just that I found this scene, I met a family in the scene.
Hell yeah.
I met a dad that's about your age, and he was with it. When we first met, there was a show in an alley. kind of like how you describe. There's an extension cord powering way too much stuff. I know people are getting shocked playing instruments. And these kids have set up a very archaic half pipe with concrete dividers, like freeway dividers.
Yeah. I love that.
And they're going ham, right? And then there's a dude behind me, and he's actually speaking English to his daughter, and she won't go in the mosh pit. And I turn around, we talk, and 3 months later he saw me again in downtown TJ with Shaka Khani, and he goes, oh, there's a show in this place, and da, da, da. And then I met his wife, and then he's got a son, and I met the son. And then, fast forward a few weeks ago, me and a buddy, I was trying to show him this cafe that shows free movies. This cafe also is the place where the punk kids have their big shows. And there just happened to be a show there. And then my buddy was there, and his son now is, goes into the mosh pit. He's not scared anymore. And that's a pretty cool thing to be a part of, scene like that, where you feel that welcome, especially as an outsider. And that's what I would hope every scene strives for.
I think every scene has had it at some point, but there's kind of like a, I don't know if it works in the wave or if it's something else now, but I don't know. It's hard. Providence, where I live now, it's a small city, but. And you would think that small city, small scene, everyone's cool, but everyone hates each other.
It's swag. Kind of swag. I don't dig it. Look, man.
U.S. is a very specific place.
Becoming friends with those 80s thrash dudes, one thing I will say is there's a camaraderie that they have that I really appreciated. Even with young cats like me and them helping people like me, and I'm nobody. So it exists. It exists.
Yeah, it does. You still see it here and there. But that being said, if anybody has a lead on a remote job that will allow me to move to Europe, please let me know.
Where you can enjoy a really good scene and healthcare. Speaking of punks, you know who was on the show recently? Do you know Oxbow? Are you too young to know Oxbow?
Yeah.
You do know who Oxbow is?
Yeah, I've heard the name.
Okay. The singer, Eugene Robinson, is a friend, and he came on the show. He's also a pretty well-known journalist, and he's moving to Europe.
Damn.
He's already got a spot.
All these chumps are moving to Europe, and I can't get the fucking job to do it. The thing is that, like, I need a U.S.-paying job to do it, which is why remote is ideal. Because I got to fly back frequently.
Hey, so some genius says Thrasher unity is okay, but Black unity is not okay. Well, if you think all Black people have all the same interests in them, that's then, I guess you're unified with Puffy then.
Mm.
Right? Puffy is part of your Black unity project, and R. Kelly is part of your Black unity project.
Kanye West.
Clarence Thomas is part of your Black Unity Project. Coleman Hughes is part of your Black Unity Project.
I mean,
Candace Owens is part of your Black Unity Project.
I mean, the thing is that, like, a lot of people you're listening are of a specific class, and so the counter argument could be like, well, Black unity among the Black work class, but even within the working class, there's been a lot of work done that there's divisions within that too. Yeah, I mean, saying that Black people in the working class are united is as ridiculous as saying white people in the working class are united. You know what I mean? There's some people.
Oh, you want to see the Gish Gallop? Do all thrashers have the same personality? Well, that's not what we said.
You said there are some people in the white working class who I can't stand. They can't stand me.
Yeah. It's a very interesting notion because I never hear people talk about white unity. I think they just believe that it exists.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you can't really talk about that. I'm not going to have a conversation with you right now about white unity.
You don't want to sing White Minority by Minor Threat?
It doesn't exist.
Didn't he stop performing that song at one point? Because he was like, what do you mean a Nazi singing this song?
Yeah.
You didn't see that coming, Ian?
All those guys are like, they didn't know what they were writing back then. I mean, I don't think any of them were like racist, but they just were fucking dumb, you know?
There's this idea that this person has that I really believe is a white person. That if you don't believe in all black people being unified as one mighty block of a minority, then you don't believe in anybody being unified in one mighty block as a minority. And I find it fascinating that they believe that. And when you say stuff like, oh, well, why don't you go fucking, you know, show me your unity block. Show me you going across class lines.
Yeah. There's no unity block, period. Maybe, no, not even.
Explain Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's class, there's certainly something to be said about the ruling class having more unity than any other. And especially that allows them the ability to exclude members or to banish members from the ruling class with impunity when they want to. When it's politically expedient to get rid of a politician, they can do it at any point. You know, all of them are corrupt. Nobody doubts that Nancy Pelosi's stock trading is insider trading and that's corrupt, but it's not politically expedient to expose her right now and take her to court for it. When it is, then they can do that. They'll do it whenever they want, but they don't. If they're not going to do it now, then why do it? Yeah, I would say that the ruling class is more united than any other class in the United States.
Well, don't tell that to this person that definitely thinks that some ass clown. I love the internet, dude. Love it.
Oh, yeah. OJ died today.
OJ died today. You know, hey, here's unity for you. Black unity is OJ getting off, right?
The juice.
The majority black.
The juice has expired.
If black unity is OJ getting off because it was a majority black jury, what is it then when a majority black jury convicts a black person of murder? It does happen more than you think, especially in these wacky things called black neighborhoods. So explain that one to me.
For real?
Yeah.
Who's this fool?
I don't know. Some old white guy.
Yeah, OJ... The juice has expired. He dead.
He is.
And the love of my life lives in Europe. And I was talking to her about it earlier today. And she told me that in Austrian newspapers, like there was some Austrian article that came out that said O.J. Simpson, famous football star, dead at 76. And she's like, I went to the comments and everybody was like, famous football star? Like, aren't you forgetting like a major part of this dude's career?
Major like, part of his career is winning the Heisman and rushing like, for 2,000 yards.
There's like, but it had renewed debate within this comment section about his murder, you know? And I think the same thing is happening in the U.S. You see it everywhere. Like, you know, all the OJ memes that are coming out are just renewing debates about guilty, not guilty, and all that stuff.
I was talking to Teray about it today, and he had a good comment. He goes, Chris Rock took an interesting angle where he was like, black people too happy, white people too mad. I was like, that was fair. I don't know if you were probably, what, like 4 during that time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Your parents probably would have been really angry.
Yeah.
let's call this a night. Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm catching up on the comments.
Oh, don't read the comments, dude. It's a dangerous world in the comments.
Yeah, I want to see this guerrilla communism shit.
Oh, I didn't send it to you?
No.
I'll send it to you.
Let me see it. I know Andrew is working on a thing, too.
Dizzle actually made a shirt.
There's
a physical shirt. Apparently, it's on its way. I will have it on air. Yeah.
Damn. We're doing it. We're inventing it. We're doing it. We're starting a movement. Guerrilla communism.
There you go.
Starting.
Happen right here. Oh, see, everybody wants to grab your old book, but not your newer book. Remember, Alex came on this show to talk about horror movies in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. If you want the punk book, hit me up on social media because I'm getting some author copies for the Europe tour, and I could just sell it to you that way. And then the money that you pay for will help me fucking traveling within Europe and stuff. So yeah, hit me up if you want a copy of that book. Also, keep your eye out for the documentary release. My Instagram is @punksaround. My Twitter is Alex T. Herbert, all one word squished together. And I also do the Lenin in 45 volumes.
I will leave as many links to Alex as possible. And
I try to do a lot of shit, dog, you know?
You know, you're a busy man. You're a Renaissance man.
That's it.
But thank you for your time. Thank you guys for checking it out. And the show will be back Saturday a.m. for me. I definitely won't be here. Be up north tending to family business. Also, don't forget, there should be a link in the description for tickets to the live show in Washington, D.C. Adolph Reed, Pascal Robert, Derek Varn, Daniel Tutt. You know, Daniel Tutt thought I was actually mad at him because he debated Haas.
Oh, shit. Lula's here. Oh, man. I'm so embarrassed about my champagne room conversation last time.
Lula. It came up the other day, by the way.
Where, how? Oh, no.
Yeah. 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 Did you see how Lula wrote? You want to read her comment out loud, Alex?
For Extreme Punks, Guerrilla Communism is an excellent band name that I've been pondering it since Alex was last on. I'll start the band Guerrilla Communism with you.
Fuck it. Speaking of Guerrilla Communism, Toussaint is putting up links to your books right now.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, if you want the punk book, reach out to me personally. You can buy it from me. Or, you know, get it on Amazon or whatever, if that's what you prefer. No, what happened? What was said about...
Oh, dude. You just went down in TIR history.
I love...
Thank God it was in the champagne room. Which is just... the champagne room last night was... We did a special one last night. It was so bad. I'm debating about taking it down.
Hell yeah. I love that shit. I was going to tell the chat to keep the shit talking coming because I love that shit. I'm an academic, man. I've been cast in the fire of criticism. Like, there's pretty much nothing these people can say to me that will, like, really get under my skin. Keep it coming, dogs. Talk all the shit you want. I love it. I'll talk shit back, man.
This is what you're famous for. Do you see it on the screen?
Scary fat lady. White.
That's a really
important detail.
Does Alex know about No, Alex doesn't, and I can't play that video again.
No, I don't. Yeah, but no, now I didn't hear anything about that appearance in the champagne, so I'm wondering what the...
Oh, dude, yeah, you came up in the champagne. Well, last night, the champagne room was supposed to be people call in and tell embarrassing sex stories. No one called in, so it was me and Mac telling embarrassing sex stories for like 2 hours. Like really embarrassing.
All right.
Like, you know.
Oh, I can see why you might want to take it down. All right.
Mac at least had a few drinks in him when he was telling crazy stories.
Dizzle, Alex is right though. Every fat white woman I've met is bad to me. You know, what is that quote? There's a quote that's like, the most revolutionary thing you can do is tell the truth. And so I just want to leave you all with that quote as I sign off of this podcast. It's the most revolutionary thing you do is tell the truth.
See, Anton says, oh, wow, I got one for the books. I wish you would have called in last night, Anton. You know what? Maybe we'll do a call-in show for embarrassing sex stories, not in the champagne room, and just do a regular Saturday morning show and open up the phone lines to everybody.
I'll call in. I've got a few, I think.
When you start thinking, almost everyone is embarrassing. And yeah. I mean, you made me feel better about one that I was embarrassed about.
Yeah. But I can give you one right now.
On the regular show? You want to do this before we end?
Yeah. I was young. So I was very young. I think I was like 19 or something like that. But I was dating this person that she was pretty cool. Her mom was like really attracted to me. her mom offered to... and like drink vodka with her, but well, I didn't do it, but that was later. But anyway, I never actually had sex with this person that I dated because my standards are very high. I'm a very prudish person, and I was back then, and I still am now to a certain extent, although I'm older, and I understand that people that I date now are older, so you have to make certain compromises in terms of standards. But the moment had come, right? We were just about to get it on for the first time. I had my pants down and she was standing up and she was starting to take her pants down too. And
because I nut quick.
And I really didn't like what I saw. And like I said, I was like, I think I was maybe 19, right? So I was like old enough where I was still living with my mom, but young enough where I was still living with my mom, but old enough that I drove. And so she took her pants off and I really didn't like what I saw. And so I just made an excuse. I was like, oh shit, my mom just texted me and like, I gotta go home and take care of some shit. Like something happened with the neighbors.
You must have saw something extremely frightening.
I'm not gonna get into that detail. It was not a penis. This is not a bash on trans people. It's not that. Well, it was just for me, for 19-year-old Alex, it was very unappealing. And so I was like, I gotta get out of here. And so I just like, I think she like went into another room to like get something. And I quickly like put my pants back up and I fucking ran out the door. And then this is the real fucked up part. I never went on another date with her ever again. I still see her here and there. She lives in Providence now. Years later, I was dating somebody who ended up being like somebody, the actual Bieber. Years later, I was dating somebody and it was like my first real like adult serious relationship. And I was really into that person, but I got a text message from this other girl's mom. She was like, what are you doing tonight? And she was cool. Like she was in the 80s hardcore. She had grown up in 80s hardcore. Her brothers were into it. She was a very cool person. And I got a text message from her. She was like, what are you doing tonight? I was like, oh, I'm just chilling. Just hanging out. She's like, you want to come over and drink some vodka? And I was like, kind of weird. I was like, no, not tonight, but like, I'll come over another time. We can catch up. And then I don't know how it happened exactly. I really don't remember. But it devolved into her describing to me how she gives blowjobs.
Whoa.
And I was like, I am at my girlfriend's house right now. I don't want to be having this text conversation. This is very bad. And I was like, you know.
How did she give blowjobs? I'm curious.
I don't remember. I mean, it was very detailed. She was talking about, like.
You know, she makes sure that the whole thing gets in there, a little bit of the balls, too.
I'm sure that was part of it. But I didn't do it, right? So I was dating someone at the time that I was very serious about that I liked a lot. So I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And I was like, I'll see you around. I hope you're well. And I think like a year or two later, this ex and I broke up. And I was like, fuck, I should have let my ex's mom blow me. It's one of my biggest regrets in life that I didn't get blown by ex's mom. It was present. It was there. I did the right thing in denying it because I was dating somebody else. I know I was right at the time, but now in hindsight, what a fool I was.
I kind of wish I could have seen this woman's vagina because I don't think it was that bad. No, in my mind, I'm thinking it must have looked like a manchichi.
It wasn't just a vagina.
Oh, she had weird thighs.
It was a lot. Yeah, it was just a, you know.
An Audi navel.
Pants can hold in a lot of things.
Oh, it was one of those.
Pants can hold in a lot of things. But like, I don't know, there's limits. But for me, it was a culmination of a lot of things. And because it happened so long ago, I feel like I've built it up into this fucking like monster in my head. Or like where I remember it now, it almost has hands at this point. it's been so long that it's just kind of the myth.
I gotta lift and I gotta slide. I gotta lift and slide. I don't know what.
And the thing is that I still see her around. I saw her like 2 weeks ago. Coincidentally at the bar with her mom, which is weird. I love them both. They're both great people. But I still wonder, does it still look like that down there?
These comments are going so bad. That's the double vagina. Oh my God.
Alex Choosy Lover. Choosy Lover. That's it. A lot of my stories are like that. It's like.
So, chat. For those of you that know the lore now of a Damien and a Harold, is Alex a Damien or a Harold? We need to know if Alex is a Damien or a Harold.
It wasn't a vagina you saw, snatch.
Oh my God. No way a Damien. Is he a Rufus? Rufus.
I don't know what that means.
Dude, you don't want to be a Damien, man.
No,
you don't want to be a Damien. Vulcan says motherfucker has his own category.
most of my weird sex stories are a lot like that. It's like me drunkenly getting into scenarios thinking that something good is about to happen and then realizing that I'm not, and so like finding ways to weasel myself out of it.
Have you ever ran out of a house with no pants on?
No, I've never done that. I definitely I got a couple of stories.
that That one is going down in TIR lore. That's pretty bad. Because at 19, yeah, there was nothing that was going to stop me at 19. Just to see one in real life, I'd have been like the Goonies finding all the gold.
One time I waited in a closet for 5 hours for someone's mom to leave.
Damn, erect the whole time.
Yeah, and naked because my pants were outside of the closet and I couldn't go get them, so I was just sitting there in the closet like hard as fuck and Colombian, and so I couldn't understand what was being said, but I could hear like her mom yelling at her and shit. And I was like, this is actually kind of hot because like she was hot, she was Colombian,
and your fucking cock's looking like Pinocchio's nose after he told 8 lies.
But I was like, how the fuck do I get out of this, right? Because her mom had gotten home from work, and her mom like got home from work and didn't leave. So, and I didn't have a phone at the time, so I couldn't communicate with my girlfriend to be like, yo, find a way to get your mom to leave for a minute. So like, I think she just got it. And eventually her mom like went to the grocery store. So this is the same mom, mind you, because I grew up like, you know, wearing the punk uniform and I had short shorts. One time I was at a barbecue and she was sitting across from me and I crossed my legs and my nutsack just fell out of my pants. Right. And my girlfriend, who was behind her mom, looked down at my nuts and then up at me to like suggest like, yo. And then I saw her mom look, and her mom just started busting up. And I didn't know what the hell was going on, so I'm just sitting there like, what are you guys looking at? Like, it's weird. And then finally like she told me like, Alex, your nuts hanging out. And I was like, oh.
Hey Alex, yeah. The bubble gum's on the chair.
Yeah, that was pretty embarrassing too. That was the same mom. She wasn't hot. She was cool though, but she wasn't hot. Only one hot mom.
And you didn't get blown by her, and you ran out of the room. Yeah. With her weird, yeah, vagina child.
Man, I actually have a lot of weird sex stories now that I think about it.
See how much fun this show could be?
Yeah.
We should do it. We should do an all-star TIR show. We bring in all these guests, and a guest tells a story.
Yeah.
Takes some calls, and then another guest comes in, tells a crazy story, takes some calls. If you guys are down for that, send me a message, and I will definitely set it up. I'm not lying like last time. Thank you guys for hanging out. We went 2 hours on this. I didn't know we were going to go so long.
She said.
Had to press that button.
You gotta get the, for me, you have to get that loud buzzer that's like just for when I'm
the
on.
The horn.
Every time Alex drops something that's like controversial.
This is kind of yours too.
Keep fucking with me.
Anyway, Lula, I'm so sorry to be offensive again. Again, this is all part of the script that Jason sends me.
I didn't send you a script today. I had one ready for you, and then you were insulting me in email. Wrong fucking country, dumbass.
Oh, I thought you meant when... when you told me that the time was different, and I was like, you people can't organize.
Yeah, you people can't organize for shit.
So in the email that Jason sent out, it said that the podcast started at 8. So at 8, I was here. And I sent him a message like, what's going on? He's like, oh, no, it starts at 9. There's like a glitch in the system. And I was just like, you people can't organize to save your lives. And then it's my only response.
I don't know. I fell out.
You people interpret that as broadly as you want.
Dude, I fell the fuck out. I fell the fuck out reading that. Oh, wait.
I found out to drop something controversial like his nut. Well, frankly, you guys can't see below the.
Keep fucking with me.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Can't see below.
Last time you guys were streaming while not live, that was a me. I did that. I made that mistake.
Yeah, we said some dirty shit. Y'all missed it.
You missed it. We're just filth, flying filth. All right. For real, we're gone this time. Thank you, Alex. I have to get ready. You post sanctions on that ass.
Yeah.
It's like every time I want to fucking end the show. You know what's really funny? Someone from Twitter was watching, and I can't respond to Twitter comments. In the program that we use. I can see them.
Can you see them, though?
I can see the Twitter comments. I can see the comments from all the different places where we're streaming, and I hope that person is still going to watch the show.
Because sometimes I'll, like, click on the Twitter feed, and I'll talk mad shit in the comments, but I can't tell if
you... It's a glitchy... It's in beta. The Twitter thing is in beta. Beta!
Yeah. He's still in the closet waiting on the colonial. It's true. There's some psychological reading that you can do there, I'm sure.
I'm just mad you had a boner that whole time.
Yeah, no, it wasn't fun. I used to, oh man, I mean, I could keep going. I'm not going to. Let's just say when you're 16 and you have access to gas station boner pills, you really need to think about when and where you're taking those pills.
Gas station boner pills are like mad caffeine and weird other shit. So you're probably crapping like a madman.
This is where the gorilla image came from, because on those gas station boner pill packs, there's one that has a gorilla on it. And I used to buy the gorilla pills all the time. I would pop that shit before school. Just so that it looked like I was always bricked up.
Bricked up?
I'm not lying. So, like, you know, because I wore tight pants because I was a punk kid, right? So yeah. I would take a boner pill before school, and then my, you know, it would be, like, impressed in my pants. So, like, people in school, they just thought that, like, yo, Alex is well endowed, but little did they know.
They're just walking around with a rager all the time.
I was gorilla pilled out. That's
why. Jim just says, why?
I don't know why, because that's what I'm saying. Well, if you're 16 and you have access to fucking gas station boner pills, you should really think about what you're doing and why.
I'm 46. Should I take a gas station boner pill?
I don't know. It might give you a heart attack at this point. These things are not good for you. He keeps saying he's punk, like that explains it. I mean, it explains the skinny pants, of course. I can't do it anymore. I'm trying to let my balls be free, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, you know me in real life, so you know how my pants roll. I don't care, dude. I'm showing the dick print all the time.
Yeah, well, then maybe the gorilla pills are for you.
Nah, dude, I'm terrified of that shit. And you know, you've seen the pharmacies down here. It's like the moment you see a pharmacy, they're fucking trying to give you dick pills. Terrifying.
Should try it next time I'm down there.
Get a dick pill?
It might make for an interesting game of tag, you're it. Pop some of those boner pills, chicken around fuck ass niggas.
What do you mean you don't want me to crack your back?
Oh man. Yeah, you guys are getting a sneak peek into what it's like when I'm on the champagne room too.
You guys are definitely getting a lot of free champagne on this show. Hey, if you guys want to support what we do here, definitely share this. It goes a long way. Drop a super chat, drop a super thanks for as little as $3 a month, $30 for the year. You can become a patron. If you're listening to the show later on Apple, just subscribe. You can get access to all of the Champagne Rooms past and present. And on that note, I'm gonna force an ending. Ooh, that didn't sound right.
No, my brother.
Hey, you hush.
You got to bite.
Thank you guys. And let's go out with some peaceful cartoons. Good night.